All right, well, we've come to the 48th chapter of Genesis, and my goal was to finish this evening. We have three chapters. Last week, I actually was planning to complete chapter 48 so that I would only have two chapters left, but was not able to get through chapter 48 last time. It ran out of time. So, Lord willing, we'll be able to complete these three chapters this evening and then complete the book of Genesis. So, where are we? When we were looking last week at the end of chapter 47, we saw that in verse 29, we see of chapter 47, it says, when the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, now if I have found favor in your sight, please put your hand under my right thigh and deal kindly and truly with me. Please do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. You shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place. And he said, I will do as you have said. Then he said, swear to me, and he swore to him. So Israel bowed himself on the head of the bed. And so we see here that Joseph was at a point in his life where he knew he was going to die. And you know, it's interesting the words that are used in verse 29 of chapter 47. It says, you know, the time drew near that he must die. And that's something that all of us must face at some point in time. We know from verse 28 that Jacob lived in the land of Egypt for 17 years. And so the length of his life was 147 years. So he's 147 years old. He calls Joseph to him at this point in time, and he asks for Joseph to swear this solemn oath that he would not allow his body to remain in Egypt after he died, but that he would take him to Canaan, to the promised land. And this was a tremendous show of faith on the part of Jacob, because what Jacob was communicating to Joseph is that he believed in the promises of God. The Lord, we're going to see in chapter 48, where he recounts the promises that God made to him. But he knew that those promises were in Canaan. They weren't in Egypt. And so although there was a prophecy that the Jews would be in Egypt for 400 years, that wasn't the end of the story. The Lord has a plan for Israel, and that plan involves going back to the promised land. And so by Jacob saying, promise me that you'll take my body to Canaan, to the promised land, he was demonstrating the fact that he had 100% faith in God and the fact that God would keep his promises that he made not only to Jacob, but also to Abraham and Isaac. And so that really brings us to chapter 48. And what we're going to see in chapters 48 and 49, this is really Jacob on his deathbed, and he is now going to pronounce blessings on his sons. And so one of the things that we have seen as we've gone through this part of Genesis where the Lord is dealing with these patriarchs, and we've been looking very closely and very deeply at the lives of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we see that it all started with the Lord making promises to Abraham about how he was going to multiply Abraham. He was going to give him a son, and he was going to multiply the descendants of Abraham to the degree that they would number like the stars of the sky or the sand on the seashore, and that he was going to give him a land this promised land. He's going to take him and he's going to bring him into a land that he would show him. And this land would be an everlasting promise that would be not only for, it would be for the descendants of Abraham. And that the family of Abraham would, all of his descendants would be a blessing to the entire world, okay? And that essentially that the Messiah would come from the family of Abraham. Well, that promise that was made to Abraham eventually was passed along to Isaac. And then later that promise was passed along to Jacob. And so here in what Jacob is doing is that he is going to pass along that promise, that birthright to Joseph, but he's also going to pronounce blessings upon the rest of his sons. He's going to basically, he's going to pronounce blessings, and he is going to essentially provide a prophecy as to what will happen with all of these, all of those patriarchs, all of the 12 tribes, all the way through until the end of time, end of the ages. And so this is really an interesting part of Genesis, because, you know, we're going to see, like, for each of the various tribes, from Reuben all the way to Benjamin, you know, what is prophesied about those different tribes, and what the fate is of those various tribes and their families, and it stems from the character of the head patriarch, and so we're going to see how that all plays itself out. But first and foremost, we're going to see Jacob initially. He's going to bless Joseph. And we're going to see some very interesting things about that blessing. So let's take a look at this. So chapter 48, verse 1 says, "Now it came to pass after these things that Joseph was told, 'Indeed, your father is sick.' And he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim." And so here we see that there became a time, it was some time after the incident that I just read about it at the end of chapter 47, where people came and they said, "Hey, Joseph, your dad is sick." And so he knew his dad was old. He knew that he was sickly. And so he knew that he needed to drop everything that he was doing and get down there right away. And not only did he go, but he also brought his sons with him, and he did so for the purpose of a blessing, you know, for his sons to be blessed along with him. And so verse 2, it says, "And Jacob was told, 'Look, your son Joseph is coming to you,' and Israel strengthened himself and sat up on the bed." And so we see here that here he doesn't waste any time. He saw that Joseph was coming, and he knew that he was literally on his deathbed. He didn't really have much time, and so he gets right down to business. He strengthens himself, you know, even though he's old and very sick. You know, the Lord gives him the strength to be able to sit up and to have a certain degree of dignity as he is going to be pronouncing blessings, not only upon Joseph and his sons, but also upon all the other 11 sons of his. Verse 3, it says, "Then Jacob said to Joseph, 'God Almighty appeared to me at Luz, and in the land of Canaan, and blessed me and said to me, "Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make of you a multitude of people, and give this land to your descendants after you as an everlasting possession. And so here we see the very first thing that Jacob says to Joseph as he recounts this blessing that the Lord pronounced upon him. And so in essence, this is the most important thing that ever happened to Jacob. In Jacob's mind, this is the most important thing that happened to him. And so we know that, you know, when a person is on their deathbed, there's not a time for, you know, small talk. There's not time for, you know, making up something. It's not time for lying. You're going to get right to the point. You're going to get to the things that really matter. So in a way, it's almost like, you know, if you're there on your deathbed and you're wanting to tell, this is the son that is his favorite son. He wants to tell him something or have him focus on something that is extremely important. He's saying, this is the thing to focus on. This appearance that Jacob is talking about is when he left from his family's house after he had tricked his brother out of his birthright, and he knew that his brother wanted to kill him. And so he's fleeing. This is at a relatively young age of his, and he's basically leaving, and he's like kind of in exile. It's not a very good thing, but the Lord appears to him at Luz, which is really Bethel, and he makes this promise to him. And so in essence, what Jacob is saying is that this blessing was a source of hope for me. It was a source of hope for me in many ways. One way is that he recognized that in essence, the Lord was passing along to him the blessing that he had given to Abraham and Isaac. And indeed, you know, Isaac had done that already. But that was number one. Number two, no matter what happened in his life, no matter how bad it got, no matter how much he was, you know, deceived by his uncle and, you know, all the challenging things that occurred in his life, he had this promise that he held on to, and it was a source of hope for him. It was a source of faith for him. And so he wanted Joseph to be aware of this promise, and he wanted Joseph's sons to be aware of it, because these promises also related to them, because it says, I will make of you a multitude of people. And he's saying, I will give this land to your descendants. So this promise not only related to Jacob himself, but it related to Joseph. And so he wanted him to know that. And so what we're going to see here in these next few verses is that if there's a question, so along the way, we've been talking about how Jacob favored Joseph, and how in essence, you know, he was, you know, looking at him as the one that he was going to give the birthright, and he was pouring into him and everything else. And so if there's a question as to, you know, is, you know, who's the one, you know, who out of all of the 12 sons is going to get the birthright, as this is unfolding, this is really showing you that Jacob is indeed looking at Joseph and saying, you're the one who's getting the birthright here. And so he is passing along, in essence, this promise, you know, because remember we talked about, what does that birthright represent? It represents you're the head of the household. You have a duty and you have a responsibility to make sure that the things of God would be transferred to the next generation and would continue to be transferred to the next generation, and that the character of God, all those different things that this all represented, you're the one who's responsible for that. And so that's why he is recounting to him this blessing and this all these promises that the Lord is making here. Now, one of the things that we might think about here is we can say, well, why is it that Jacob is giving the birthright to Joseph? That doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem fair. You know, Reuben is the oldest. But there are a number of reasons why this is the case. First of all, even though the firstborn is the one who's supposed to receive the birthright and the blessing, the double portion, we know that the Lord has not done that for four generations, right? So Isaac received the birthright and the blessing over Ishmael. Jacob received it over Esau. And then now Joseph is receiving it over Reuben. And then later on, we're going to see as this chapter unfolds that Ephraim, who is the younger, is going to receive the blessing or the birthright over Manasseh. So that's number one. But the other thing that is significant here is that Jacob all along, you know, when he was told by his mom to go to his uncle's household and take a wife there, the wife that he wanted to marry was Rachel. That was Rachel was the love of his life. That she was the one that he wanted to marry, and only her. And if things had worked out the way that he desired, then Joseph would have been the firstborn. And so for him to get the birthright and for him to be treated as the oldest son is the rightful thing, at least in Jacob's eyes. So let's continue on here and look at this. And verse 5, it says, "And now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine." And so here we see Jacob telling Joseph that his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, they are going to be elevated in their status. So instead of being considered sons of Joseph, Jacob is telling Joseph that they are being adopted essentially by Jacob, so that they are now in the same position as all of the other 12 sons, just like Reuben and Simeon. So in case, it wasn't enough for him to say that they're mine, he wanted to make it clear in the same exact way that Reuben and Simeon are sons of mine, direct sons of mine, that's how Ephraim and Manasseh are going to be considered. And so what he is doing effectively is he is giving Joseph a double portion. So by including both of his sons there amongst the other sons, Jacob is communicating or he's basically realizing that the most effective way to give Joseph a double portion is to adopt his sons and have them have the status of the other sons. And so that's what he does. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, throughout the Bible, there are various lists. There are lists of the 12 tribes, and they have different sort of variations. We saw that when we were going through Revelation. But in many cases, what they'll do is Joseph and Levi will be missing out of the list with Ephraim and Manasseh included. And so they truly were elevated to that status of being actual direct sons of Jacob. And then in verse 6, it says, "Your offspring whom you beget after them shall be yours. They will be called by the name of their brothers in their inheritance." And so essentially what he's saying here is that if Joseph were to have more children other than Ephraim and Manasseh, those children would be considered sons of Joseph. They would have that status. So the point is that Jacob's objective here is to give Joseph a double portion, but only a double portion. He was not trying to have him get anything more than that. And so that's what is going on in verse 6. Verse 7, it says, "But as for me, when I came from Padan, Rachel died beside me in the land of Canaan on the way, when there was but a little distance to go to Ephrath, and I buried her there on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem." And so he is now, you know, remembering Rachel, the wife that he loved, the love of his life. And in essence, that was, you know, what I alluded to before, that it was that thought of the fact that he really loved Rachel and he really only wanted to marry her. And that is one of the reasons for making Joseph the one that would receive the birthright here. The other thing too, it has to do with burial instructions in essence, because he's talking here about how and where he buried Rachel. And so the instruction that he was giving to Joseph to not bury him in Egypt, but to bury him in the promised land, he wants to be buried there in Canaan. So verse 8, it goes on, and it says here, "Then Israel saw Joseph's sons and said, 'Who are these?'" And so up until this point, Jacob did not realize that Joseph had brought his two sons there. And he is up in age here, as we know. And he, like his father Isaac, his eyesight had failed him. And so he couldn't really even see the people very clearly. And so he looked and he was like, who are these people? And then Joseph said to his father, "These are my sons whom God has given to me in this place." And he said, "Please bring them to me and I will bless them." And so when he knew that Joseph's sons were there, he wanted to bless them. And so he asked them to bring them forward so that he could do so. And then in verse 10, it says, "Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age so that he could not see. Then Joseph brought them near him, and he kissed them, and he embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, 'I had not thought to see your face, but in fact, God has also shown me your offspring.'" And so here when Joseph brings his sons forward, he kisses them, and he embraces them, and he is really praising the Lord. He's really worshiping the Lord because he's saying, "You know, I didn't even think that I would ever see you again, Joseph. I thought that you were dead and I would never see you again, but the Lord has blessed me to such a degree that he's allowed me not only to see your face again, but he has allowed me to see your offspring." And so that's what he's saying here. Verse 12, it says, "So Joseph brought them from beside his knees, and he bowed down with his face to the earth." And so we see here that Joseph, in this whole time of blessing, he's showing a tremendous humility here, because Joseph is this man who it has been elevated to be the number two man in the greatest country in the known world at this time. But yet here he's bowing down before his father. He's still recognizing that the prominence of his father and how the Lord has blessed his father, and there is a destiny for the family. And so he is not being proud and saying like, oh, no, you don't need to bless me, you know, I'm good or whatever. No, he chose a tremendous humility, and he bows down before his father. He wants to be blessed, and he wants the blessing to go forward with regard to his two sons as well. And so now Joseph, knowing that his father is basically blind, he can't see, he's going to try to make sure that he can help his father in pronouncing this blessing upon his sons. And so what he does here, let's see what he does in verse 13. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand towards Israel's left hand, and Manasseh with his left hand towards Israel's right hand, and brought them near to him. So in essence, what Joseph does here is he is going to make it really easy for his father, Jacob, to bless his sons. What he does is he takes Ephraim, and so he's standing facing his father, and he takes and he pushes Ephraim forward towards, so that he would be right next to Jacob's he could be right next to Jacob's left hand. So he takes Ephraim with his right hand and he moves him forward so that he would be close to Jacob's left hand. And he moves Manasseh forward with his left hand so that he would be close to Jacob's right hand, because the right hand is a hand of strength. And that's where the best blessing was gonna come from. So he made it easy so that all that Jacob had to do was stretch forth his hands just forward, and the blessing would go forth the proper way. Verse 14, it says, then Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And so even though Joseph set it up so it was like foolproof, like there's no way that he could make a mistake, when Jacob stretched forth his hands, he crossed them. But notice what it says here. It says that in verse 14, it says, guiding his hands knowingly. And so essentially what's going on here is Israel or Jacob is being, he is completely filled with the Holy Spirit, and he's being guided by the Holy Spirit in everything that he's doing right here. And so here, Jacob is completely yielded to the Lord right here. And, you know, which brings me to an important point, and that is that we all know from when we went through the book of Hebrews, there is what we call the Hall of Faith, right? In Hebrews chapter 11. And in that Hall of Faith, they're recounting like all of these men and women of faith, and you know what they did to demonstrate their faith. And what's interesting is that when in Hebrews chapter 11, when it comes to Jacob, it doesn't talk about like all the other things that happened in Jacob's life. It doesn't talk about like when he was there and he had that dream and he saw the angels on that ladder going up to heaven and the Lord looking down. It doesn't talk about when he wrestled with God and the Lord, you know, took his hip out of joint. And it doesn't talk about any of that. What is discussed in Hebrews chapter 11 is what we're reading about right here. It says, by faith, Jacob, when he was dying, he blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshiped leaning on the top of his staff. So there is something about what he's doing here that is demonstrating faith. So here he's blessing his Ephraim and Manasseh, and he is demonstrating a faith in God that what God promised to Jacob, what God promised to Abraham and Isaac, it doesn't stop with them. It's moving forward. It's going to, that promise is still going forward. And so this is the faith that he's showing, but there also is included in all of what he's doing here is a tremendous amount of worship that he's, you know, like we see it in different parts. Like, for example, when he was talking about how he never thought he was going to see Joseph again, but now the Lord has shown me his offspring. Like he is praising the Lord. He is worshiping the Lord for what he's done. But then look at verse 15 and 16 here. We see even more worship going forward. It says, "And he blessed Joseph, and he said, 'God, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads.'" And so here we see these three things. He is worshiping the Lord for how the Lord had been with his father Abraham and Isaac, and he had been with them all throughout their entire lives, and he walked with them. And so there's worship there, and there's also a show of faith. He's also talks about how God has fed me all of my life. So in other words, he sustained me. He's provided for me. That word "fed me" actually means he has shepherded me. He has led me, and he has taken care of me. He is just like, you know, you think about the 23rd Psalm, about how, you know, David talks about how he leads me by the still waters, and he makes me to lie down in green pastures and all that kind of stuff. That's what he's talking about. Like, all his life, as difficult as it was, he's saying the Lord was always with me. He was always taking care of me. He was always feeding me. He was guiding me. He was shepherding me all my life, up until this very day. And then he says the angel, and that angel, capital A angel, he's speaking of a pre-incarnate Christ, basically. He said he has redeemed me. He's delivered me, basically, from all evil. These are things, both that word "fed," which is shepherded me, and that word "redeemed." These are new things. Like, these are, you know, kind of what we talk about, like a first mention type of things here. And so he's saying, and so he is worshiping the Lord, and he's demonstrating the faith that he had in the Lord. And he says, "Let my name be named upon them." So what he's saying, name, we know that the name of a person is their character. And so he says, "Let my character be upon them." And he's talking about the character of Israel, right? The character of one who is governed by God, one who is led by God. And he says, "And the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac." So even to have the character of his father, his father Isaac and his grandfather Abraham, the faith that they had and the way that they walked with the Lord and trusted in him. And it says, "And let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." And so that this is the blessing that Jacob is pronouncing over Ephraim and Manasseh. And verse 17, it says, "Now, when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. So he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head." And so Joseph, he looks up and he notices, oh, he messed up. He put his right hand on the younger one and his left hand on the older one, and it was displeasing to him, and he thought it was a mistake. He's like, wait a second, you know, you're, and so he wanted to stop him before he completed the blessing here, because he thought in his mind that he was making a mistake. And because in his mind, his oldest, Manasseh, would be the one who would who would have the birthright and who would have the greater blessing here. But we see here in verse 18 what happens. It says, and Joseph said to his father, not so, my father, for this one is the first one. Put your right hand on his head. But his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also should become great. But truly, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall be a multitude of nations. And so we see here that Jacob, again, he's led by the Spirit, and he knows. This is not a moment of, you know, Alzheimer's disease or something like that. He's saying, I know what I'm doing. The Lord has revealed this to me. The Lord has shown him what will become of these two sons. And so he says, you know, Manasseh, he says, he also will become a people and he also will be great. But truly, his younger brother is going to be greater than he is, and his descendants shall be a multitude of nations. And the truth is that both of these tribes will become great in the history of the nation of Israel, but Ephraim will clearly be greater. And so some of the great men from Ephraim would be Joshua would be an example, Samuel would be another, and then also Jeroboam, but you know, Jeroboam was the one who led them into idolatry, and he's the one who created the split of the northern tribes from the southern tribes. But what takes place, though, after the split is that Ephraim was part of the northern kingdom, and Ephraim was the most prominent of the tribes in the northern kingdom, to the point where the northern kingdom was referred to as Ephraim. Okay, that's how great Ephraim was. And then verse 20, it says, so he blessed them that day, saying, by you Israel will bless, saying, may God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh. And thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. And so the point is that they, what Jacob is saying is that they're going to be such, they're going to be blessed to such a degree, these two sons of yours, these two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh, that when people bless others, they will be pointing to them. They'll say, may you be blessed, you know, as Ephraim and Manasseh are blessed. That's how blessed they were. And then it says here, and thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. And so he made it clear that Ephraim was the one who is, you know, is being treated as the oldest and is the one who's getting the birthright, the double blessing, so to speak. And it wasn't a mistake. That was the way it was. Verse 21, it says, then Israel said to Joseph, behold, I am dying, but God will be with you and will bring you back to the land of your fathers. And so, you know, we can look at this and it says, I'm dying, but God. You know, that's kind of how I have it highlighted in my Bible. Here's a man who's on his deathbed and he's saying, I'm dying, but that's not the important thing. What's important is God, you know, but God. God, when I die, it's not like everything dies along with me. It's continuing. God is alive. God is going to continue to be with you, and he's going to bring you back to the land of the fathers. He's looking beyond the pyramids. He's looking beyond Egypt to the time when they, when the Lord brings them back into the promised land. Verse 22, moreover, I have given you one portion above your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and bow. And so he is giving, again, Joseph a double portion. He's giving him one portion above his brothers. So then that brings us to chapter 49, and we'll start out. I do feel like I'm kind of running out of time here, but let's go through and let's look at as much of chapter 49 as we can here. Now what's going to happen is now that he is that Jacob has blessed Joseph and his two sons, and he's given Joseph the birthright, the double portion. Now he's going to pronounce blessings upon all of the other brothers. And as part of what he's going to do, it is really just flat out prophecy, but it's also there's blessings here. There are cursings here. There are judgments. There are promises. There are warnings. And even a warning is a blessing in the sense that it tells you that you're not going the right direction, and that there are things that you need to do to get yourself right. And also those warnings could be warnings to the other tribes as well as they hear them. And so what he's gonna do is gonna talk to them about what's gonna happen to the tribes over the course of time in the last days. And what we're gonna find is that the lives and the nature of the patriarchs of the various sons, the various tribal leaders, it will color, right, what takes place in their descendants. And so God, through Jacob, is providing this prophecy to sustain them throughout all of the difficulties that they would encounter in Egypt, to let them know that there is a future, there's something beyond Egypt, and this is what it's going to look like. So chapter 49, verse 1 says, "And Jacob called his sons and said, 'Gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days. Gather together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel, your father.'" And so here he is, again, he's on his deathbed, and he's giving his final words. These are the final words of a father to his sons. And he is completely and utterly filled with the Spirit, and he's being led by the Spirit. The words that he is speaking are coming from the Lord, and he is telling of what is going to take place. So verse 3, it says, "Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity, and the excellence of power." And so you read those words, you hear those words, and he's probably thinking to himself, all right, I'm going to get a great blessing here. You know, he knew that he had done something wrong, right? We had read about how he went up and he slept with his father's second wife. And his father didn't say anything about it at the time, but now he's going to do so. But here he's pointing out all of the things about Reuben. He has all of this potential, all of this promise, all of these opportunities. He is strong, excellent, and dignified, and excellent in power. But yet, in verse 4, it says, he is unstable as water. He says, "You shall not excel because you went up to your father's bed. Then you defiled it. He went up to my couch." And so even though he had all of that going for him, all that promise, all of that potential and everything, It says he was unstable as water, and what, you know, water is basically, it has no form to it. It follows its own path. It just kind of goes where it wants. It gravitates to the lowest point, right? That's what water does. It goes to the lowest point that it can go. And it really demonstrates the same character or the same act that Reuben did. He allowed his sinful desires to run wherever they wanted to go. And he didn't have any self-control. And it led him down to a low and sinful place where he disregarded everything. He disregarded the love and respect that he had for his father and for the rest of the family. And so as a result, he essentially, as we know now, he was passed over as the one who would receive the birthright. You know, many people say that the reason why Reuben slept with his father's wife the way he did was so that he could put himself in a position, right, where he would definitely be the possessor of the birthright. But we can see from what Jacob says at the beginning, he didn't need to do that. He had, you know, might and strength and excellency. He was perfectly positioned to be the one who would carry the birthright, but he messed up. Then he turns to Simeon and Levi, and he says, Simeon and Levi are brothers. They're instruments of cruelty in their dwelling place. He says, let not my soul enter their council. Let not my honor be united to their assembly. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. And so now he links Simeon and Levi together. And he's now referring to what they did when their sister was raped in Shechem. And they deceived all of the men of Shechem to be circumcised. And so they used this this thing of God that was to be a symbol of being consecrated to God. And they tricked these people into doing this so that they could murder them in a cold-blooded way. And so Jacob rebukes them here. And he basically says, you know, they were instruments of cruelty. And he says, let not my soul enter their council. Like, he doesn't want to be associated with that kind of the acts that they did, the cruelty and what they've done. He doesn't want his honor to be associated with them. And so again, this is a warning. So the first one was a warning about lust, and how lust can cause you, if you allow it to control you like Reuben did, it can bring you down, right, into a very sinful place. Here he's warning about anger and cruelty and how that can do likewise. And he says, I don't want that to be associated with me. Essentially, it's not a thing that should be associated with Israel. And he says, let not my honor be united to their assembly. And he goes on to say, cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. And he says, I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. And that is truly what occurred. The fulfillment of this is that when they came into the land of Canaan in the time of Joshua, Simeon, the land that was given to him, it was completely engulfed, or it was completely inside of the land of Judah. And so in essence, they became like a sub-tribe of Judah. They didn't have like a distinctiveness. And so in that regard, they were scattered. And then likewise, the Levites became the priestly tribe, which was a thing of grace that occurred. And instead of receiving a designated place of land there in Canaan, like all the other tribes, they received 48 cities that were spread or were scattered throughout the land. And so that prophecy came to pass. So I'm going to just cover Judah, and then we'll stop, and then we'll pick up where we left off next time. Judah, it says, "You are he whom your brothers shall praise." And so we know that the name itself, the name Judah, means praise. And it says, "Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you." And so, you know, after hearing what Jacob had to say about Reuben and Simeon and Levi, I'm sure Judah was feeling pretty bad because he had messed up too. We know about what he did in terms of with his daughter-in-law and everything else. But we also know that he demonstrated a lot of integrity when they went back into Israel and they brought Benjamin, and he said that he was going to be a surety, and he, in fact, he followed through on that. And so we see here some really amazing things that are being said about Judah. Now, we know that the Messiah comes from Judah, and all of the things that are mentioned here are demonstrating that. He says that your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. So he's basically saying you're going to be victorious over your enemies. It says your father's children shall bow down before you. And so it's saying here that his tribe is going to be preeminent. So that those words are very similar to the words that were spoken to Joseph in his dream. He's saying that the children of his father, he's basically saying his brothers, right, are going to bow down before you. What an amazing thing. And we know that happened, right, because we know that Jesus came from the line of Judah, and every knee is going to bow and every tongue confess. Verse 9, it says, Judah is a lion's whelp. So it's a lion's cub, basically. And so we see first here this mention of a lion, and we know that Jesus is the lion from the tribe of Judah. And it says, from the prey, my son, you have gone up. He bows down, he lies down as a lion who shall rouse him. And then verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. And so here, that word scepter is talking about the staff, or essentially that a monarch would be holding on to when it's when he is pronouncing a decree. And it talks about a lawgiver, nor a lawgiver from between his feet. So what we're seeing a lion, right? A lion is like the king of the jungle, right? We're seeing a scepter, we're seeing a lawgiver. And so all this is pointing to royalty. So basically this is to communicate that all the kings, you know, the kings are going to be supplied by this tribe of Judah. And it's saying here that the scepter will not depart, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. And we know that the scepter, like the rule of the kings, ends, and then is when Shiloh is referring to the Messiah. And so the Messiah comes when the scepter departs. And so this is clearly a very strong prophecy about the Messiah coming from Judah. And to him shall be the obedience, or the gathering of the people. And even right now, we're fulfilling that prophecy, right? We are gathering in the name of Jesus. But there's even a greater gathering that this is speaking of. And then it says, binding his donkey to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washed his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine and his teeth whiter than milk. And this is speaking of the millennial reign and what it's going to be like, and how it says binding a donkey to a vine. No one would ever do that because grapevines are very valuable, and you wouldn't want to bind a donkey to the vine because it would destroy the vine and the fruit. But they're saying it's so, in the millennial kingdom, it's going to be so prosperous and so fertile that you can bind your donkey to a vine. And it says he washed his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes. Again, just how plentiful the grapes and the wine are, that you could even wash your garments. But it's also, it's hinting at the blood of Jesus. Whenever it's referring to wine and blood of grapes. And then it says his eyes are darker than wine, and his teeth whiter than milk. And this is talking about health, you know, very strong health, you know, the dark eyes, the teeth that are white, whiter than milk. And there's no, this is talking about supernatural health that will take place in the millennial kingdom. And Isaiah talks about how if someone were to die at 100 years old, it would be like they died as a child. And so we know that it would be very, very healthy for people in the millennial kingdom. So we'll stop there. And my goal of finishing up Genesis, I didn't make it, but we're making our way along here. And Lord willing, next week we'll wrap up of Genesis, where we've left off here.